Today, drastic steps to try to slow down coronavirus in Italy as the outbreak spreads across Europe. And we hear from one of the most influential diplomats in the world when it comes to tackling the climate crisis.
People in the north of the country have been plunged into chaos after the government decided to lock down Lombardy. The news sent thousands into panic. Thousands of people jumped into their cars after the draft decree was approved. People were worried and scared in the north, but in the rest of the country, life went on.
For Italy, coronavirus took hold in the north, in the region of Lombardy, with its capital of Milan. It was there that Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte focused his attention this weekend when he announced in the middle of the night that he was placing the region's 16 million citizens into quarantine. He warned, this is a national emergency.
The Italian government announced today it is imposing strict new rules to prevent the spread of coronavirus. It's the toughest attempt to contain the virus outside of China and the first time such a measure has been taken in Europe in centuries.
Guardian writer Lorenzo Tondo was covering the crisis from Palermo, an Italian city almost 1,500 kilometres to the south. And then the drastic measures were extended to the entire country.
On Tuesday morning, and for the first time since the beginning of the outbreak, I saw people wearing masks in Palermo. What they only saw on TV until yesterday has arrived here today. People are anxious, confused, scared. The restrictions that until yesterday applied only in the north now also apply to everyone here. And not everyone understands those rules. People in the south are still wondering what they can and cannot do, where they can and cannot go. The streets of Palermo are empty and silent. To see a few people, you have to go to pharmacies and supermarkets where hundreds are lining up to grab supplies of water and pasta.
While Lorenzo has been covering the social and economic impact of this growing epidemic on the ground in Italy, Peter Beaumont has been tracking its spread, from a handful of cases in the north to a national crisis that is now placing an entire continent on alert.
The virus is doing what the virus does, which is trying to affect as many people as possible.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how Italy lost control of coronavirus. Peter Beaumont, you've been writing about the spread of coronavirus for The Guardian. And we think about it arriving in Europe in February, and in particular in Italy, but presumably from what we know about this virus, it was here well before that.
Yeah, I mean, the theory now from people who've looked at the different strains of the virus, that in Italy in particular, it's probably been circulating since probably mid-January and probably elsewhere in Europe as well. But then we started seeing the cases with symptoms actually start appearing in February, which is to be expected with the incubation period and the way that people fall sick.
By the 6th of February, Italy had 3 reported cases. What did they do?
There was 2 Chinese tourists who were put under quarantine. I think they thought that they were on top of it and handling it. But as it turns out, there was actually a case already circulating in the north of Italy.
Do authorities have there in Italy any leads on how this outbreak started in the north of the country?
Well, that is the main concern here, this patient zero. That's the first.
I mean, as soon as they realised that they perhaps hadn't contained it, obviously they were looking for what's called patient zero, the first infected person in the country, because they realised that the links that they were making weren't necessarily correct. I mean, what they actually settled on and identified was a patient one removed from patient zero, who was a manager at Unilever. He'd started coming down with flu-like symptoms. He didn't have any connections with China that he knew of at first. He then presented several times at a local hospital. And because in that period he was going around and everyone was looking at him and going, oh, no, you don't have coronavirus because there's no obvious China link. What he actually did was infect a whole bunch of people, several people at the hospital, several people in a cafe. And it's been a kind of familiar pattern. There's been, you know, you see this sort of tunnel vision where people are looking for a combination of symptoms that match coronavirus, which could be a lot of things, but also the link to China. And as we've seen in the United States and elsewhere, what's tended to happen is that people presenting with potential symptoms for coronavirus, but where there's no apparent link, are sort of slipping through the dragnet. And that's where the infection begins to take hold and you begin to get community transmission.
Are there individual examples of how quickly this can spread?
And there have been some really striking examples. There's been the case of patient one, and there's also been the case of this Italian man. It's a sad story. He was in his 70s.
The man had traveled to Cremona to visit his daughter, and upon returning, he began to experience flu-like symptoms.
Unfortunately, he dies.
Basically, a post-mortem test revealed the man was infected with coronavirus. There was a problem. The result came out only after his body was released to the family for his funeral.
He picked up the virus, he infected his daughter and his family. You have people coming to sort of commiserate. There are contacts between the family, friends, people shake hands, hug each other. And before you know it, a number of people have been infected and dozens more people are in isolation because they've come in contact with this cluster.
If doctors had waited for the test result before handing over the body to family members, perhaps dozens of people could have been avoided the infection.
Okay, so that's how it was spreading under the radar. Was it starting to show in the figures?
On February the 21st, there were 17 new cases reported. You know, by the 23rd, you know, 2 days later, they're talking about 73 new cases. And it looks like an explosion. But I mean, that's not all happening in those 2 days. And that means that there has already been sort of fairly sustained transmission locally.
And that big shift in what was happening on the ground led to the first big shift in policy from just doing temperature checks when people arrived in Italy to locking down towns in the Lombardy and Veneto regions. What were they trying to do with that?
Well, I mean, they still thought there was a fairly small outbreak they could contain. So they looked at the communities where you had significant clusters and they were trying to prevent people from leaving. I mean, if you like, it was kind of a softer mini Wuhan in several towns, you know, looking at what had happened in China.
By the 29th of February, there were 1,128 cases and 29 dead. What were they trying to achieve with the restrictions and what else were they discussing?
I mean, I think they thought that they'd got it under control. But I mean, the new infections and the deaths kind of were demonstrating that the initial notion that they'd got it under control was perhaps probably a mistake. And, you know, there was a political row about this, although people quickly stepped back from it, with the Prime Minister sort of accusing the local hospital of not having followed the right protocols. Now, with the best will in the world, the virus is doing what the virus does, which is trying to affect as many people as possible. The mistake in the approach was that people were looking, you know, in terms of containment, contact tracing, identifying, and this is America as well as Italy, they were looking for those people with symptoms and a connection to China. But what they weren't looking for was the much more difficult job of saying, look, we've got people coming in with respiratory crisis, fevers, in the middle of a flu season, and actually trying to identify the cases that didn't fit. And those are actually the more difficult and, in a way, of the more dangerous cases, because those are the ones you're not seeing. Someone made the point, you know, the good news about coronavirus is that the symptoms are often very mild. The bad news about coronavirus is that the symptoms are often very mild. And so in the midst of a flu season, it's getting missed.
Meanwhile, the cases continued to increase. By the 1st of March, there were 556 new cases, almost 1,700 in total. By the 3rd, 2,500. By the 4th, 28 new deaths. That was the highest jump in a single day, up to 107 in total. Is that when they changed the response?
Yes, I think they realised that it was getting out of control. They needed much more drastic measures.
In Italy tonight, 16 million people in the country's hot zone now in lockdown. That's more than a quarter of its population under quarantine, with cases soaring to more than 7,000 infected and 366 deaths, a 30% spike overnight, the most fatalities outside of China. Travel in.
One of the problems that's emerged over the weekend is that, you know, Italy being a democracy with a free press, news of the proposed decree leaked out. You know, we saw on social media people posting video of people getting wind of this and trying to flee the areas that were going to be under quarantine.
Panic at this train station. Passengers desperate to escape, fearful trains would be shutting down.
Because I read 2 hours ago that they may be putting out an urgent decree, putting Padua in the red zone, and because I'd like to return down south to my relatives, I decided to go earlier.
And Lorenzo, that must have caused a lot of distrust for people, and for politicians, it must have caused alarm.
Authorities, seriously, they fear that these people who are leaving Lombardy, you know, they are carrying the virus into the lungs of their brothers, their sisters, their grandparents, uncles, cousins and parents.
There are two issues here. I mean, it's been, as the World Health Organization has said, you know, the quarantine measures in China were incredibly successful. But Italy has a different social and political system. It's got a different media. And people have not been anywhere near as accepting of it. I mean, they've been critical of the response and unhappy about the measures that have been introduced. And I think that is going to be something that all of us living in Europe will probably confront in the coming weeks, is that balance between individual rights and politicians making decisions that they think are for all our goods that infringe on those rights that a lot of people are not going to like.
Presumably part of the reason people are worried is that they're already seeing the social cost of this.
In a country on the edge of a nervous breakdown, 6 inmates died in prison riots around the country. They are protesting against the new government decree that, due to the coronavirus, restricts FaceTime with visiting relatives. Prisoners in Pavia took 2 prison officers hostages for hours, while other jail riots were sparked in Salerno, Naples, Alessandria, Vercelli, Bari, Palermo. In Foggia, several inmates have managed to get out after tearing up a gate at the blockhouse and are in the road outside. We're facing a real emergency. It's catastrophic what's going on here.
Well, we've had breaking news on the coronavirus outbreak from Italy in the last couple of hours because the government is taking yet more drastic action. The entire country has now been placed under lockdown.
And then on Monday, we get the kind of extraordinary news from Italy, from the Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte.
The government is forced to intervene even more decisively to protect all of us, and especially the most fragile and vulnerable people. And this is why these lockdown measures, already declared for the northern parts of Italy, will apply to the whole territory from now on.
They're doing that at a time that the death toll was rising and rising, first to nearly 500 on Monday, now higher again. Why did they do that and what does it mean?
I mean, I think it was inevitable given what happened with the first weekend announcement. I mean, maybe for Italians, perhaps it will seem fairer now that it's not just the north, that everyone is in the same boat. Maybe it's more politically acceptable to do this as a nationwide thing than simply focus on the north.
And what was the aim?
Contain, delay, and to try and stop as much as possible coronavirus getting to the south of Italy, which is much more economically disadvantaged, that has a much weaker healthcare system. And I think this helps protect the situation in the south from what's going on in the north, which perhaps has more capacity to deal with it.
Peter, we're hearing and seeing all over the world governments trying to grapple with some really difficult decisions around this. The question is, how far should they go in restricting the freedoms of their citizens and imposing what is basically a self-inflicted economic wound in order to slow down the spread? The other option would be to let coronavirus rage. And if they did that, it would rage for a shorter period and then be over. What's the advantage in trying to delay things?
I mean, we as individuals tend to think that the thing about coronavirus is that we really don't want to get it and we don't want members of our family to get it. So we think quite individualistically and personally about it. When people are designing overarching health policies for things like this, whether it's the World Health Organization or the National Health Service or any government, what they don't want is to have a huge surge of cases in a short period of time that overwhelms a health system's ability to deal with critical care. So the ambition is to turn the cases on a graph from looking like a little pointy mountain into a speed bump. You want the bottom time axis to be much, much longer, and you want the cases to come at a rate that a health system can deal with. And, you know, that's often where the tension resides, is that while we're thinking, well, our government should stop us getting it, what our governments and kind of health organisations are thinking, you're probably going to get it. But what we really want to do is make sure that it isn't a complete disaster for a health system. And that's quite a competing demand.
Lorenzo, you're in Italy where they're desperately trying to slow down the spread, but the numbers are rising at a worrying rate. Is the health service coping?
The situation in the hospitals in the north is catastrophic. Hospitals in Lombardy are literally on the brink of collapse. The sick are being placed in operating rooms or in hospital corridors. And I think that the worst is yet to come.
And what about the economy?
The economic cost is, is immeasurable. It's going to have a huge impact on people's life. Imagine tourism, for example. Imagine how this will affect all the hotels and restaurants and tourist infrastructures in the country. I think that's seriously measurable. And the thing is that I think it's going to last for a while. Let's say, like, if the virus will magically disappear by the spring, I don't think people are going to come in the summer. I don't think our economy will grow in the summer. I think this is something will probably bear the consequences of this situation for years.
And what about the rest of Europe? What's happening?
Different countries are taking different approaches. Jens Spahn, the German health minister, I mean, Germany has opted for a sort of softer approach so far. I mean, they are asking people if they really need to go into work, whether they can work from home.
Official recommendation by the German government to cancel big gatherings of more than 1,000 people. That is definitely a big change in tone. It is still up to regional lawmakers and organisers to implement this ban and to have the final say, but they've already...
The suggestion is that you don't take public transport. The difference there, again, is they're talking about keeping the kindergartens open because they're worried that that health staff with younger children especially will not be able to come into work if they have to care for their kids. So their focus is on keeping those kind of younger school-aged children in school so that they can sustain their health system. In France, I mean, you're seeing gradual move from stage two to stage three of the response. Gatherings are being limited in size. I mean, it's notable that Madonna, who was supposed to be playing in Paris, has cancelled. Six Nations rugby match between Ireland and France has been postponed. There is a suggestion there may be restrictions on public transport and, again, school closures. But, I mean, those are going to be rolled out probably in the next few days. And of course, the cases are rising here and people are looking to Europe and asking, well, as of all these options, what are our politicians going to choose for us? And I don't think anyone quite knows at the moment, do they?
And one thing I found quite striking when you're talking to me is that Italy has been doing fairly draconian things, locking down towns, for example, since the time they had fewer than 80 cases. I mean, here in the UK, we've already got over 300. We haven't taken similar steps.
Yes, it's a slightly frightening pattern that's repeating around the world. You sort of, sort of hope against experience. You see each country report a few cases. You sort of think to yourself, oh, well, that person was in China, or that person's just come back from Italy, or that person's come from Iran. And, you know, you see it apparently contained and then suddenly it starts popping up. I think it's one of the health officials said here at the weekend, it's like, you know, it's not the clusters of linked cases you should be worried about. It's these cases that seem to be popping up slightly at random, because we kind of know from looking at the graphs and we know from looking at the geographical distribution, we know what the virus is going to do. I think what people are beginning to slowly internalize here and elsewhere is that there's a good chance it's probably going to be the same, and people should be prepared for that. If the UK has one advantage, is that we're coming to this slightly later, so we can look at what's worked in some places, what's not worked, what we think will work. I mean, the thing that no one can know is we're sort of moving from a containment policy to a delay policy, is we can't know how successful that's going to be in a UK context. I mean, we can look at Italy, we can look at France and say, well, these are things we didn't think worked. But the virus itself doesn't really care about what country it's in or what the politics are or what the social system is. I mean, the virus will do what the virus does, and we're only really going to see how successful our approach is by testing it against what happens in real time.
And I guess one of the reasons we look at Italy with alarm is it's so much closer to home and the number of cases are rising here. Do we think that where they are now is where the UK is likely to be in a couple of weeks?
I mean, I think that warning's been delivered by Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock. I mean, we've listened to their language over the last week and a half, from
in case it becomes a global pandemic
to
watching what is happening around the world, containment is extremely unlikely to work on its own. And that is why we are making extensive preparations for a move to the delay phase.
A big outbreak is inevitable. Even if you don't want to take Italy as your model and you look at France and Germany, I think there is a significant risk that that pattern will just keep repeating itself in the countries that it arrives in, because that seems to be what it does.
That was Lorenzo Tondo and Peter Beaumont. With warnings that Britain could face a similar increase in cases, we'll be looking at how ready our health services later this week on Today in Focus. There is also a Science Weekly extra on coronavirus out tomorrow. Do keep listening and reading all the excellent coverage online at theguardian.com, including from Lorenzo and Peter, as well as from reporters across our news, health, science and politics teams. Coming up, how do you persuade countries with very different priorities to come together to tackle the climate crisis? Now, Cristiana Figueras is a global authority on the climate emergency. The Costa Rican diplomat led the UN Climate Change Convention when the 2015 Paris Agreement was achieved. Ahead of this year's critical climate conference, COP26 in Glasgow, she explains how she managed to secure cooperation between very different countries.
From 2010 to 2016, I was the executive secretary of the Climate Change Convention, and it was my job to bring 195 nations together to not just participate in a common effort, but actually to agree to a legally binding framework and have everyone agree that that would be a common framework within which every country, every sector can find its way. So it's not a straitjacket, but it is an overall direction with a final destination. What comes as a surprise to many people is that I am not a natural scientist, because I deal with climate change. I'm actually an anthropologist by training. And what that really helped me to hone was the skill of very, very carefully and profoundly listening. listening to everyone in equal standing. Every country, every position, every sector is equally valid. And those questions and that attitude of learning was one that led to building trust and having confidence that I really did have their interests at heart because I had totally understood it. I did a lot of travel, unsurprisingly, since I was dealing with 195 countries. And the one country where I went most often was actually to Saudi Arabia, because it is evident that any framework that seeks to curtail greenhouse gas emissions is actually going to curtail the one export product that Saudi Arabia has, which is oil and gas. And it also happens to be the one resource that brought them out of poverty. They were a very poor country. And when they discovered oil and gas, they have become one of the richest countries in the world. So you can understand that anything that threatens their economic growth and, in fact, even their economic stability is a huge threat for them. So it is predictable that they're going to try to stop the advance of anything that they perceive is not in their self-interest. So I did spend a lot of time with them to try to understand for myself, how do they see their future? They actually live in one of the hottest areas of the world. How are they going to deal with increasing heat? And they came to understand that it is also not in their interest to have runaway climate, to have something that is going to produce so much heat that it even worsens the conditions that they already have. They don't have any rivers. They don't have any precipitation. They have to desalinate all of their water. So they don't even produce their own food largely. They have to import all food. And of course, if you have to import all your food, you're actually interested in all other countries being able to produce food. And if you get to the point where most of the world is uninhabitable because of heat and lack of water, then you have food problems. So they came to understand that, and not because I told them, but rather just questions about how do you see that into the future? And so they also joined the Paris Agreement. And that perhaps comes as a surprise when you compare Saudi Arabia to, let's say, the 40 very, very small and low-lying Pacific islands whose survival depends precisely on curtailing emissions. So they sit on two completely extreme positions. But if you engage with them to think in the long term, eventually they actually come around to see actually they're both threatened and therefore they have a common interest.
That was Christiana Figueres. Her new book, which she wrote with her UN political strategist, Tom Rivette Carnock, The Future We Choose, Surviving the Climate Crisis, is out now. The pair also have a podcast, Outrage and Optimism. That's it for today. My thanks to Lorenzo Tondo, Peter Beaumont and Christiana Figueres. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres, Courtney Youssef and Jessica Murray. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.